What's up, Internet? I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative professionals and entrepreneurs looking to grow, not only by learning new things, but by connecting their work to big ideas and overcoming the barriers that prevent them from doing the work they were born to do. Welcome to episode 179, Tests, Experiments, and Taste, with Lauren Gutierrez. Lauren is a Los Angeles-based cinematographer, and in this episode, we talk about learning visual language, the importance of looking at art other than film, how context and collaborators can help you with comparing yourself to others, Instagram as a way to showcase your taste, the value of tests and experiments, and the best definition of collaboration. Show notes and links for this episode can be found at gwtw.co/179. Lauren, thank you so much for being a guest on Getting Work to Work. Why don't you start by introducing yourself and share a little about what you do?
Yeah, thank you for having me. So I am a Los Angeles-based cinematographer. I graduated from AFI last year. So I've been shooting for about 4 years now. I moved to LA 4 years ago from the Chicagoland area.
Wow.
I worked as a camera assistant on really small movies and, you know, indie features, and just kind of cut my teeth on a lot of small projects when I first moved out here. Mm-hmm. And I did that kind of with the aim of building a foundation in the camera department so that I could eventually work my way up to being a cinematographer. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wanted to apply to AFI at some point down the line. I had heard great things about the program. I admired a lot of DPs who graduated from that school. I just thought I was going to do it a lot later in life than I did, but I ended up volunteering on a lot of the projects that they put up, especially the first year students. They shoot films called cycle projects that they're always looking for outside grip and electric help on. So I did a ton of those because I wanted to start learning about lighting. I only had like the very, very most basic foundation, like what a C-stand is, what a tweenie is from undergrad. So I started working on these as a way to gain experience, and I just ended up meeting so many great people and becoming involved in that community to the point where I thought, oh, it's probably a good idea for me to apply now, even though I feel like I might not necessarily be ready or as experienced as I'd like to be going into it. And, you know, who knows if I'll get in. And I kind of just got lucky and so kickstarted my cinematography career a little bit earlier than I thought I would. And I've been shooting shorts, music videos, branded content, and an indie feature since graduating last year.
Nice. Congratulations. What I appreciate about your journey, and correct me if I'm wrong, but did you always aspire to be a cinematographer, or did you aspire to be a director? And then, you know, a lot of people aspire to be directors and then choose writing or cinematography or, you know, a path to get to being a director. So it sounds like you wanted to be a cinematographer from the get-go.
Kind of, well, in high school, I wanted to be an actor. But, you know, as I kind of fell out of that interest, as I became an older teenager, as a young teenager, I wanted to be an actor. Anyway, I guess I thought I wanted to be a director when I was about 15 or 16, but not because I knew what it was. It was more for like lack of knowing what the other positions on set were. I don't think I even knew what a cinematographer was when I was 15, but I saw the movie Atonement when I was about that age, and that was the first movie that really, really hit a chord with me in terms of my experience as a viewer absorbing the visual language. And, you know, I think visual language affects every viewer, no matter how old you are, no matter what you know or don't know about movie making. But I think this was a really kind of perfect confluence of my changing consciousness of what visual storytelling was and a certain quality to the visual storytelling that I either hadn't noticed or hadn't seen or just, you know, hadn't understood in movies before. And so that was the first time that I thought, like, so much is going on here. There has to be somebody other than the director who's guiding this and who's guiding the camera. And that's how I learned what a DP was, because I started Googling the movie. Seamus McGarvey was the first DP that I really, really admired, because he shot that movie, many other great movies too. And just kind of learning what a DP did from that made me realize, oh, that's what I want to do. The director is a step too removed for me, for my taste, from camera work and from lighting and from really having a kind of tactile experience with visual storytelling, which is not to say that, of course, they're not incredibly important to the visual storytelling, but, you know, they're also working with actors, working with costumes, working with sound. And it was, to me, it was the specificity of visuals that made me want to become a DP. And that's kind of how I found out what it was from there.
Kind of touching on visual storytelling a little bit, because in today's world, visuals are everywhere. So, you know, how has your pursuit of visual storytelling changed over the years as you become more educated, as you get more experience, but also as you see what other people are doing?
That's an interesting question. I mean, it is true. Images are everywhere, but a lot of them are so conventional and repetitive. You know, there's a certain look, I think, to a lot of music videos, depending on the genre, that people come to expect when they're looking at them on their phones, for example. There's a kind of visual that you expect when you're looking at a fashion magazine, lighting-wise. All of this stuff is very much the same. So I think it's just about a process of refinement that's slow, and it takes a lot of time, and I'm refining my sense of visual language all the time, as, you know, every filmmaker is, I think, as they progress in their career. And when I look back on my older work, I notice that I'm trying to do similar things to what I'm trying to achieve now. I've always liked high contrast. I've always liked a sense of darkness and of deep shadows, but I think there's just less refinement to the technique. At first, it was about shooting as much as I can. Now I'm trying to be more selective about what I put my energy into, because I don't necessarily need to shoot things just for experience. Nice. But yeah, I noticed that there's a steady refinement to the craft. Like, when I look back at my work from 4 years ago, there's a lighting style that I'm trying to achieve, but there's just something that's slightly off about the lighting ratio, or something that's off about the quality, or something that could have been done, but I didn't have the experience going into the shoot to analyze the limitations of the location and change my plan to adapt to those limitations. And then the failure to adapt shows up in the work. And as you kind of look back on those things and say, okay, this is what I can take away from that experience, this is what I've learned from that failure, you can put it into the next thing that you shoot, and then see the change in technique and see the improvement if you're conscious about noticing what got messed up the last time. Yeah. So I think that's mostly how my process has changed and how I can see it changing all the time. And then I think, you know, I'm also trying to look at a lot more still photographers and sculptors and painters more, I think, than I ever have in my career, and trying to look at other forms of art as a way to inspire cinematography, as opposed to only watching movies. Because I think when you look at other forms of art, that can inspire you to make something that looks different from what other people see all the time. And, you know, kind of like I said before, we're inundated with visual language every day, but a lot of it is so repetitive and so conventional to the point where, you know, you could have hundreds of different artists producing these images and you wouldn't be able to tell them apart. So I'm trying to be conscious of, if I'm making something look slick simply to make it look slick, or, you know, there's a certain, I think, desire to make stuff look professional and look pretty and to be satisfied with that. And, you know, it is a skill to be able to make something look glossy, but at the end of the day, there's something that's more valuable than that. And so I try to push myself to make things, like, if I notice myself falling into that trap of just, like, making a soft far side key, you know, that looks good on everyone, and repeating that over and over again, to try to break that pattern and to do something different. Even if the execution is not as good, at least I've tried something new, and hopefully I can refine that to make something that looks different. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it's great, because what I'm hearing is, like, you have an amazing ability to constantly learn new things and take risks. Mm-hmm. And where did you learn that? Because that is an amazing skill to have.
I mean, I don't know if I have. I'm trying to develop it. But I think it came from talking with other students at AFI and realizing that we all had a common frustration with shit that looks the same. When you watch a movie, you know, a lot of, like, the Marvel movies that come out, they all have a really, really consistent look because they're dictated by a big studio. And, you know, there's a number of reasons why they have to look the way that they look. Certain actors have to be lit in certain ways. When you're releasing a big movie, not that I'm shooting big movies, but we all had a common frustration with things that looked the same. And so I think there was this fire that we lit under each other to try new stuff. Because I think in the same way that audiences become bored with movies and television that are derivative, artists become bored when the specific aspects of their craft kind of show the same stagnance. So it was really from being in that community of AFI of like-minded people that inspired me to try new things and to focus on that and to realize that that was the goal of my career and not necessarily to only make things that looked quote-unquote professional.
No, that's really cool because I think a lot of creatives in all industries, I think really wrestle with, I think they just wrestle with taking those risks because, you know, when someone's writing a check, you know, and they have mm-hmm. a specific need and you have the ability to satisfy that need, sometimes that can take precedence over learning new things, taking risks, and getting out of the boredom that right. really is modern society in a lot of ways.
Yeah, you know? I mean, I think there's also a time and a place for it. Like when you're talking about somebody cutting you a check, sometimes the reality of a job is you are a hired gun and you have to deliver a product a certain way, and you just can't take it personally that they don't want to see like this new thing that you have to try. You know, so it's less that I need to, you know, push for a lot of creativity on those types of jobs and more like I need to identify those jobs for what they are and just be conscious of not taking too many of them because the check can be tempting.
Yeah. So you've talked about kind of the, you know, redundancy of modern visuals and mm-hmm. things like that and how things look very similar, mm-hmm. but what are some other challenges that you are facing as a cinematographer in LA and how do you work through them?
I think a lot of the challenges that come from LA specifically really stem from your own vices and insecurity because there are so many people in LA trying to be DPs, especially young people who are talented, who have had access to technology in a way that filmmakers have never had in their lives before. Mm-hmm. Because the market is so saturated with people, it's almost impossible to not compare yourself to other people who do what you do and who do it well and who make you sometimes feel like you can't do it well. And that's a really scary thing. Like, and I think a lot of DPs do this. I've had conversations with other DPs of like, okay, who's the DP who you go on Instagram and you're like, I just want to die. I look at this and I'm like, I can't keep up. I give up. And everybody does that. Even the best of the best cinematographers have had moments in their careers where they think they're going to quit. And, you know, these are people who are ASC now and people who you would never expect might feel that way. But I've had personal conversations with very successful people who have also had this insecurity complex. And I think in LA specifically, it is so hard to avoid that because you're surrounded by other people who do what you do all the time. And I've never really been a cinematographer in another city, so I can't say, you know, that this doesn't happen in other cities. But I would imagine that maybe it's a little more difficult in LA because it's such a saturated market of creative people.
Yeah. So how do you work through that? Do you just avoid Instagram?
No, I love Instagram. Instagram's great for my career, actually. And it's a way to show your taste. And so I don't avoid Instagram. But what I try to do, I think, is have a little sit down and just try to have a little context to have a reality check on my career and think about, okay, you've only been out of AFI a year. You're definitely not the most successful person in your class. You're definitely not the least successful. You know, there's just value in reminding yourself that this comparison, even though it's hard to avoid, is not helpful to you. And just to surround yourself with people who respect what you do and who like working with you. That's one of the reasons I like working with Meredith so much, who I know you interviewed a few weeks ago, because I really respect her as a director. I like working with her, and I can tell that when I voice an opinion about a shot, she listens to me and, you know, she works with me in a way that makes me feel like what I do is valuable. So I think it's also about finding collaborators who can bring you up when you don't necessarily believe in yourself.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned something earlier that just like triggered a thought. And I love this idea of Instagram as showcasing your taste. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes it's just like, you know, we lunch, you know, lunch is my taste, you know, but you know, this idea of taste being, you know, these are the things that visually intrigue me or the things that I'm experimenting with. Right. So, you know, how do you approach Instagram as a showcase of the your taste and your aesthetics?
I'm always posting either stills from things that I've shot or stuff that I've just shot on my iPhone or stuff that I've shot. It's a lot. It's like a big mix of iPhone stills and then 35 millimeter because I love playing with my SLR. And I think photography is just like the greatest form of therapy and great practice for being, you know, for a DP who wants to create in their downtime. And, you know, it doesn't depend on having a crew and a ton of lighting gear necessarily. Like stills for me is kind of a creative outlet where I don't have so much of the logistic pressure that I have in my everyday job. And so it's showcasing that and kind of like showcasing what's going on in my head on any given day when I feel like posting these still photos. It's kind of, it's a diary in a sense, right? Like a photo diary. And it's a way for me to show things that I've been experimenting with that I think are interesting, that are not necessarily perfect, but that kind, that shows something different from what you see on a lot of other DPs' Instagrams. I've been really inspired by infrared photography lately. So I just started messing around with a friend's camera the other day because I decided I was going to teach myself how to do it since I had a few days off. And I've been trying to, in my days off, find ways to trick myself into working because I'm a workaholic, but I'm trying to find ways to stay inspired and to keep growing my base of knowledge. And, you know, I'm not prepping this infrared stuff for any specific project, but I'm doing tests to try to better understand how it works. Tests that are, that look relatively professional, that are well documented, that are useful to me, that could be useful to others, and that maybe I can use one day. You know, that's one way that I've been using Instagram to show people that I'm doing this, that I'm taking initiative to learn something new, and hopefully that's yielding interesting results.
Well, and that's something from my understanding. A friend of mine is a cinematographer. I think, you know, I'm Nathan Milkey.
Oh, Nathan is so great. Yeah.
Yeah. I've known him since he was in high school.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Back when he was making, you know, his live action feature length Lego stop motion or Playmobil stop motion movies.
Nathan made a Lego feature.
Yes, he did. It was a Playmobil, actually. It wasn't Lego. It was Playmobil. And you should ask him about that one day.
Oh my God. I'm going to text him as soon as you cut.
But one of the things that when I watch some of the things that he goes through, and you just touched on it too, is this idea of tests. And like, you know, I never really connected it until you just said it. But, you know, it sounds like the job is all about testing and trying and documenting, you know, what you're going through so that when you're in the moment, you have all of this practical knowledge of testing and experimenting that you've done. And I think that's pretty awesome because I never really connected that before.
Totally. And it makes the difference on set, like with, you know, even with a basic over under test of a camera where you are pushing it to the limit of overexposure and underexposure to understand basically what the camera can and can't do in the highlights and shadows. And even doing a test as simple as that can save you a lot of time on set from knowing, you know, if this is overexposed and for whatever reason, it's going to take a long time to get the grip gear in XYZ position up this flight of stairs, whatever it is, to cut it, you can make a decision of, do we need to do that? Or do I know that we can save those highlights in post with the contrast curve that I'm expecting to use? Because it's not as simple as just looking at the waveform and being like, oh, it's clipping or it's not clipping. Sometimes you're in a situation where you know something isn't perfect, but you have to be able to make the decision of, do we do it now or do we do it later? And sometimes it's better, you know, people joke about fixing it in post, but sometimes that is better than spending unnecessary time on set to create a shadow on a wall versus something, you know, versus making a power window in post that you could do extremely easily if it's a static shot and, you know, versus like setting up several solids that it would take to make that shadow. You know, this is a very vague example. I'm not even picturing anything specific right now. But I think you get what I'm trying to say is that even doing a simple test gives you the ability to make more informed decisions on set that directly affect the workflow and that directly affect whether or not you're making your day, that, or whether or not maybe you're getting like an extra shot that you know that the director really wants to get. And if you get it for them, you can be like their hero that day and you'll get hired again. It's a chain reaction that happens from testing.
How do you develop the confidence in voice and technique? So like when you're in that moment and you have to make the decision of whether, you know, being okay with it going overexposed a little bit. I mean, how do you have that confidence to go to the director and say, you know, this is overexposed and it's intentional? Or do you just have those moments of like, yeah, I'm confident that this is the right decision and they'll trust me to make that confidence? Or do you second guess yourself?
I think that comes with experience. So, I mean, sometimes I still second guess myself if I'm doing anything particularly technically challenging that I've never done before, or maybe there wasn't the budget or the time or resources for a specific test, you know. But I think in terms of getting the director to trust you and having confidence in those decisions, it often involves showing the director your test results and kind of, you know, if they're open to it and if they want to see it, like really getting into the nitty gritty of why you're making certain lighting decisions. And then, yeah, just like including them in the results of a test. Because there are certain choices that you make as a DP regarding exposure, regarding the strength of diffusion that you're using, or, you know, any the stop on the lens that you're using, that a director might not immediately know or care like why you're doing them. But if you can show them the difference, if you can really show them why it's better to shoot with a slightly bigger budget and more lights at a lower level of exposure for a cleaner black level versus a little bit scrappier with less money, less lighting at a higher level of exposure. If you can show them the difference in the noise floor, especially when you're like seeing it on a big screen, they'll never unsee it, you know? Nice. So it's something that happens between you and the director at pre-production, really getting them to trust you, I think.
Did collaboration come natural to you? Or has it been a process of discovery, of learning how to connect to people and be able to almost speak the same language as another creative person?
I think when I was a student, like in elementary school, middle school, like I was always very good at group projects, if that's what you mean. I mean, I think especially like growing up as a woman, you're always taught, you're socialized to be agreeable with people, to listen to their opinions before just offering your own first off the bat. And, you know, to really consider other people's thoughts and feelings, because you have to in order to be accepted. And it's a blessing and a curse. And the blessing of it is that it makes you a collaborator who, if you can gain the strength to also have your voice heard, which is, you know, kind of the challenge of that, that's the other side of the double-edged sword, then collaboration becomes a joy instead of a struggle. So collaboration, I think, came naturally to me in that sense, because I was always having to listen to people when I was growing up, and I was always having to hear what they had to say before I offered what I had to say, which is not a bad thing necessarily. Like I said, if you can learn to speak up for yourself and to participate equally, then it makes for a great collaboration. What I really had to learn, and what I think I started learning how to do at AFI truly, was this idea of developing a common language, and that collaboration is not just about playing nice with people and listening to them and really, really considering what they have to say, but also about looking at tons of images together and not just looking at them and saying, I like this, I don't like that. And being like, you like this movie? I also love this movie. Great. We're going to get along just great on set. You know, it's about being specific and about pointing out the aspects of images that you like and saying why you like them. Because there are so many times when I've looked at an image with a director and we're both like, oh, this is great. And then on second thought, you know, you look at it and you're like, well, is it only great because there's something in the colors that is really compelling that matches what we're trying to do? But the focal length is totally the wrong choice for us. Or, you know, you love the level of contrast, but the director loves the design elements. And that's the only reason they like it, you know, because it fits the period of the piece that you're doing. And they don't actually want that contrast ratio, you know? So it's about being specific with these references and about being specific when you're developing these pieces of common language and knowing why you like the things that you like, and making sure that you're on the same page as to what gritty means, what pastel means, because everybody defines these things so clearly in their own head, but when you actually take them out of your brain and compare them, they might be incredibly different. So yeah, specificity to visual language is what I think makes for good collaboration.
Yes, that is actually, I would say, the best description of what a collaboration is, because just the fact of it's developing a common language. I mean, you just like, I don't know. Thank you for that. I have no other words other than, wow, you just like awoke something into my brain about what true collaboration is. Thank you.
Well, thank you for letting me. I feel like I had to babble to get there, but I got there. So.
No, you totally got there, because I'm just like, I had never considered that it is a common language, even though that makes complete sense. And I don't know why I've never considered that, but awesome.
Yeah. And I think that's so important to do that, because again, you know, a director might show you tons of images, and they're showing you these images because there's some quality of, like I said, let's say of color that they like, but you could look at these images and see a common theme of contrast ratio that they weren't even thinking about. And then you start lighting that way on set and they're like, why can't I see the other side of the actor's face? And you're like, no, I thought we looked at these images together. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's important to do that so that you avoid this kind of confusion in the future.
So you've touched on lighting, you've touched on the emotions of images. What kind of stories captivate you? What are you drawn towards when you're reading a script or you're talking with a director?
The stories that I'm drawn towards, I really love genre films. I love sci-fi. I love horror. Mm-hmm. I love dark comedy.
Nice.
Which is not to say that a script has to be any one of those things in order for me to enjoy it. But I'm realizing more that as a DP, those are the kinds of things that I would like to be shooting, because stylistically, I think they're satisfying. Emotionally, they're satisfying to me as a viewer. I think sci-fi especially introduces a lot of interesting thoughts in a viewer's brain because of the way that it can tackle certain social issues or, you know, certain societal issues that we're not allowed to talk about in such concrete and literal terms, but we are allowed to talk about when it's happening in another time, in another place. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes.
But I think in a script, what every DP is looking for is not only some kind of emotional fulfillment when they're reading it, you know, you imagine watching it, of course, and you think like, is this emotionally satisfying to me? Do I feel as though the characters are real and human and that they touch me in some way? Not only is it that, but you're looking for a quality that tells you why this is a movie and not a play. Mm. Not just that it's dramatically satisfying, but that there is something that can be visually illustrated. And then it's not all just talk, and two people sitting across a table talking to each other, which can make for, you know, some incredible filmmaking just because it's incredible performance and drama. And that I think is like the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs in a movie, is like, it's true. It's like, are the performances and the writing compelling? That's the first thing. And then if everything else is great, but that's not there, it's like, who gives a fuck? Nobody's going to like that movie. It's true. People walk out of movies all the time saying, oh, that was terrible, but it looked really cool. But nobody walks out of a movie saying, oh, that was great, but it didn't look very good. You know, they just say like, that was great, period. So that's the foundation. And then I think as a DP specifically, you're looking for something that inspires you, that you can visualize and that you can really see how this drama can be externalized with lighting, with contrast, with camera moves, whatever it is, whatever your weapon of choice is for that particular script. There has to be a reason that it sticks out to you as a movie and not a novel or a play or some other thing.
Mm-hmm. In what way do you allow limitations into your process? I mean, obviously budget is probably going to be one of those limits, but do you ever enter in like stylistic limitations or things like that?
Yeah, I do. This was actually the example that comes to my mind was a movie that I shot in Portland last summer, where we had to shoot a scene that had these two goth kids like running through a cemetery and then they kiss in front of this mausoleum. And we had like an hour and a half to load in and shoot this and load out. Wow. And we had a very small grip and electric crew. I actually had a full camera team, but I only had my gaffer, my key grip, and a swing. And I was just like, fuck, like, how am I going to light the cemetery? How am I going to make it look good? You know, you think that you need tons of lighting tools for a night exterior, which for the most part is true. But given the right geography, we were really blessed to have practicals in the background. At least for one of the options, we were going to look in one direction or the other. One of them had practicals in the background. And I was like, okay, that's automatically something that we could maybe silhouette people against. I feel like when I'm in these situations where I'm up against a wall and I don't have a lot of time to light, to me, the quickest way to make something look good is, how can I most efficiently either get contrast from one half of the face to the other, or contrast from foreground to background? Because if you don't have at least one of those things, then the image falls flat. So I saw practicals in One Direction, and I was like, okay, even if I can't light all these trees and stuff, at least having this background will give it shape and will tell you where we are, and and might even, you know, look visually compelling. I'm really inspired by silhouettes because I love Gordon Willis's work in Clute in Manhattan. Like, he just uses silhouettes so powerfully, and for some reason or another, that's something that really speaks to me. So I kind of gravitated towards that. And in the scene, these kids were also, they were supposed to be waving sparklers because it's 4th of July. And in my mind, I was like, that's the thing that's going to be lighting their faces, because they're holding up the light source right to their face. It's a beautiful color. The way that the light falls on a face when it's very close, if it's in the right position in relation to the camera, often is gorgeous. The way that it wraps around and kind of makes this Rembrandt triangle underneath the eye that's closest to the lens. So I thought, okay, that's the solution. And then the fucking fire marshal goes up and is like, you can't light sparklers. And I'm like, well, that was the whole plan for lighting their faces. So we had to like search around at the last minute for like who on the crew had flashlights instead, that were similar color temperatures to each other, because each character had to be holding one. And so it looked crazy when they like tried to underlight their faces with them, not at all the way that a sparkler would look. So then we decided that they would just be like running through the cemetery with them, and that as they kissed, they would kind of just, their hands would fall aside and they would flash the wall behind them. And then they became silhouetted against that, and it actually kind of became one of my favorite moments in the film, and the thing that they keep using to promote it, and it kind of became like this little iconic image for the movie, totally by accident. So this is kind of a long-winded way to say that I think thinking on your feet with the limitations that you have and having an MO to go to of like, in my mind, like I said, it's, if I'm in a pinch, what is the quickest way to create contrast? What is the quickest way to do it between the foreground and the background or on either side of the face? Like, I try to think of concrete rules that I can go to that will help me make those decisions when you're in unexpected situations, or when you have limitations like that that come up at the last second.
That's fantastic. What a, you have an amazing way of putting things too, because like you're describing the scene. I've never seen it, but I can follow you, and I'm tracking your decision making, and I imagine that ability to communicate is key on set.
Definitely, it definitely is, especially when you're working with a bigger crew where information has to trickle down from you to your department heads, to their best boy or best girl, to the electricians and the grips, or to the camera PA, you know? So I try to be clear and specific when I speak, and the more that I work on set, the better I get at it, and the more that I realize how critical it is. And just communicating to the department heads ahead of time, hey, this is where I anticipate we'll be looking next, which, you know, hopefully with a bigger crew and the first AD is doing that. But often, you know, on a smaller crew, especially a smaller non-union crew, it often falls on the DP to help steer the ship and to tell their crew, like, hey, just so you know, we're turning around and looking at this next. Or just so you know, this was supposed to happen in the schedule, but now that XYZ with the location has changed, this is what I expect we're going to be looking at instead. Like, just keeping everybody abreast of the changes that are happening is so important.
What big ideas and stories are you aspiring to bring to life in the future?
I mean, like I said, I'm really trying to rebrand myself, so to speak, as a genre DP. And so I'm hoping to shoot more horror and sci-fi in particular. And so those are the kinds of stories that I'm really interested in helping to tell, because those are the kinds of things that I like to watch. But that said, I have a couple of shorts hopefully coming up that aren't at all in the realm of sci-fi or anything like that. But I'm interested in them because they have characters who are very human, who are very compelling, and you know, kind of like we were talking about before, they present an opportunity for me to externalize their conflict. And there's something in the script that told me this can be visualized well, as opposed to this should be a play or this should be a novel. So I'm really just hoping to make stuff that I would like to watch, I guess. I don't know how to put it more specifically than that. I'm sorry.
No, I think that's great because, you know, that's what you're aspiring to do. And I think sometimes we, as the creative society, I'll say, sometimes likes to put down the whole self-gratification or self-enjoyment phase of work creation. So it's pretty awesome that you have an idea of what you want to make, because not only do you enjoy it, but obviously a lot of people enjoy sci-fi and horror. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just visually they're exciting. Sci-fi in particular, I think, from Blade Runner to Alien to stuff that's coming out now, like Ex Machina, and, you know, sci-fi new and old. And, you know, Alien isn't even that old in the grand scheme of things. Like, you can go back to Metropolis, right, for sci-fi movies that are incredible. Just visually, to me, it's always been so striking when it's at its best, and so inventive and so daring, that it's the kind of thing, you know, if I could be as innovative and as exciting as Jordan Cronin with the work that he did in Blade Runner, that would be the dream. And I think the visuals of straight drama and the storylines of straight drama to me just were never as compelling in comparison. So.
Well, Lauren, this has been a fantastic conversation. I just have one last question for you. What books or resources have you constantly learned from or recommended to other people?
That's an interesting question. I met with a younger DP the other day, who I sent a list of resources to. Let me look that up really quickly. I think I told her, I was like, you should buy the American Cinematographer Manual just because the technical information in there is so solid, and it's relatively up to date, and like, you can get digital copies that get updated. Anything technical that you don't know has an answer in there. So I would say the ASD manual is a great thing. Film Grab is a wonderful thing for a DP to use. Have you ever used Film Grab before?
No, I've never heard of it.
It's awesome. So basically, it's just a website that collects like 50 or 60 high-res stills per movie that they list. And they're listing movies new and old every day. You can search by aspect ratio, you can search by director, by DP. And it's just a great place to download high-res stills for a personal visual library, like when you're swapping references with your collaborators. I also really like the American Cinematographer Magazine app, because you can search, if you have a subscription, you can search on your phone or an iPad for a specific phrase, like G-series anamorphics or underwater photography. You know, like, you can search any specific phrase and it'll return the articles that discuss those things. So it's just kind of like a quicker way to research things that you want to research. And then other than that, I mean, I just find that going to museums and looking at photographers that you like and doing stuff other than movie making that is still visually fulfilling is the most important thing. Because when you're on jobs that are long or frustrating or creatively unsatisfying, you need that stuff to keep you going, and to remind you that there is light at the end of the tunnel. So just, it's so important to find your own ways to get, like, your own fountain of inspiration, whatever that may be. And it's less about the technical resources, more about like finding this thing that can kind of become a talisman for you creatively.
Awesome. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a fabulous time of just learning about you, learning about how you approach your work. And I feel highly educated now. It's awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciate it.
That does it for this episode of Getting Work to Work. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast. It means a lot to me that you do. I really appreciate all the comments I get throughout the week about how much you are enjoying the monologues and interviews. Would you be willing to share Getting Work to Work with your friends, other creator professionals, and entrepreneurs? You can send them to gwtw.co or have them search for Getting Work to Work on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Would you like to be a guest on a future episode of Getting Work to Work, or know someone who should be on the show? Maybe you need some advice or just want someone to say hi to. Drop me a line by sending me an email. I'm Chris at chrismartinstudios.com, or you can find me on Twitter and Instagram. I'm at CM Studios. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.